accession number 28355, Real 4.
The Comet had ingested ice in one engine and you'd landed at San Francisco.
Landed at San Francisco, where we spent the night. And as the only airman on board, I was sort of left with the responsibility of trying to sort out how we got on from there. And so the first thing to find out, you know, what they could do about our Comet. So once they got on to making phone calls in those days was a lot more difficult than it is today. And I wasn't that familiar with Transport Command or the ops room. Anyway, I got a hold of somebody who knew what they were talking about. And yes, they could get an engine out, but you know, it'd be 48 hours or something. And I said, well, you know, the Secretary of State has got this itinerary. What can you do to help? Well, it so happened that CNC Transport Command was Bing Cross. And his Comet, in those days, Commanders-in-Chief also got Comets, private Comets. Was in New Zealand, and I think he was on a fishing trip. He was officially visiting the New Zealand Air Force, and that Comet could be positioned at Fiji if we could get ourselves to Fiji, and yes, the civil airlines could get us to Fiji. So that's what happened. So we left our Comet behind. We went civil air to Hawaii. I still got the necklace, I think I was given one of these. And went to Fiji, where we picked up the Comet, which took us to Canberra, and then on to Singapore. And for some reason, Dick Hull and I separated, and I went back on an RAF transport aircraft. And I think he was staying in Singapore for a few days. But it was, you know, an interesting experience in sort of global trip. I had one other occasion to go around the world with Dick Hull when he did a round the world trip. And that was brilliant. And we had our Comet. And we went first of all to Greece and then to Turkey. And then on to, I think, Bahrain and Singapore. And then up to KL, and then down to Australia, and across to New Zealand, where Dick Hull went off fishing from the ADC. He went off to South Island. We'd landed in the Comet at Wellington, and the ADC and I, he was a 17th 21st Lancer captain, and I had brought our rods with us, and we went to fish Tongariro, at least that was the idea. And so we hired a car. We were eventually to meet up with the Governor General up at Wellington in his residence, where CDS would have returned and the Comet would have repositioned Wellington. And we were then going on to Fiji and Fiji, Jamaica, Bermuda, I think, and home. So anyway, our fishing trip wasn't a great success because the heavens had opened and the Tongariro was in spate and the tree trunks coming to it. I don't know if you're a fisherman, but it wasn't very successful. But we did fish taupo and caught a couple of fish which were, you know, yay long but too small to keep, so they said. Anyway. And we met up with CDS back in Wellington and continued our trip. It was, you know, a great privilege to go on trips like that. Stayed with high commissioners or governors general in the high commissioner's residence in KL. Like marvelous sort of view of the balcony, everything pressed to the nines. I learnt, I think, on that trip that you don't ask to be unpacked, or you say positively, please don't unpack me. Because at KL, everything had been unpacked, including my sponge bag. And it was still the days of steam razors, but every razor blade, every bar of soap, the shaving brush and everything would all be laid out. I don't like people dealing with my private possessions at the best of times. But you know, one did experience, you know, great luxury. And you learnt, you know, various places where the governor was the Queen's representative, they got served first, regardless of the guests. So blink slightly and then you realise somebody told you. That was part of my experiences with Dick Hull. I stayed on with Sam Elworthy for about 7 or 8 months. Dick Hull went in the autumn and I went the following spring.
That would have been the spring of 68.
Yes.
Yeah.
And by this time I'd been made a group captain and I went to be the unit commander at station commander at Cranwell.
Which is spring 68.
Yeah. I mean, it was a great change to work for Sam Elworthy, who was a lovely man I got to know well as a result of that, and subsequently, he was the first airman to end up in this house.
Yes. Yes. Well, this looks like being a good point to conclude, and I'm going to conclude, if I may, with this one last question then on this point before we revert to your more conventional RAF career, other than fishing in New Zealand. And that is, did you get any impression when you were with... Dennis Healy was with you during part of this, wasn't he?
Oh, yes. I that's when I really got to know Dennis Healy. And I've got a nice letter somewhere on file where he wrote to each one of us who'd been on that round-the-world trip saying it's not often people go round the world. And certainly not in such a short time. I think it was slightly over the 8 days, but you know. But thank you very much, sort of thing. It was rather nice.
And my question is, you said that he was there to sell or certainly promote the latest defence review.
He was there to explain. To the Americans and also to the Australians, because, you know, we were members of SEATO, as well as, you know, the American and NATO connections. Why Her Majesty's government was, you know, making these massive cuts, changes in the UK defence posture. You know, they were fairly significant, I mean.
Yes, of course.
Going into the details. And they needed some selling, certainly to the Americans.
And my question is, to what extent did you, at your level, get an appreciation of how well he was doing?
I wasn't involved in the... You know, I mean, not being his private secretary, Pat Nairn would sit in, but I was as MA. I mean, I'd sit in with CDS normally, but if, you know, he was talking to the... I don't actually remember an occasion when he did talk to the Joint Chiefs of Staff on this. So I was only a wing commander, so I wasn't sort of expecting to be swept up and being. I'd achieved a lot just to be on the ride.
Yes.
And I looked after his papers. I wrote all his thank you letters. We brought certainly on the other round the world trip. We had his stenographer with us, and so I would write all Dick Hull's thank you letters to the High Commissioners or the thing, and he'd sign every one of them without altering a word. I don't think I got it right all the time, but obviously I got it right enough for him not to send me back to my kennel. But it was quite an experience, you know, and writing speeches too. I remember going from Australia to New Zealand. He discovered that he was going to have to speak to a staff coach or something. And so I and the stenographer put a speech together for Dick Hull, which he used. And, that was certainly working a little under pressure, you know, for a 3-hour flight or 4-hour flight. I need a speech. And you know, you need to see it before we landed.
Yeah.
So there were moments when, you know, the pressure was on.
Yeah.
I never minded that.
No.
And one thing is sort of thinking back. Have we got time to just finish this thing?
Because
because I was lucky enough to end up as CDS, one tends to make some comparisons between your experience and the experience of your predecessors. And they would never appear in the office before about 9:30, 9:45. And they both lived in Kingston House, where eventually I lived as CDS to NCS. And they'd get driven as far as Green Park and then probably walk across to Ministry of Defence main building. So it was a pretty leisurely sort of approach. And they would be off, well, probably they had in a dinner engagement or something, so they were gone by about 6:30. When I was CDS, everything had started much earlier. I mean, to a certain extent, you're not your own boss because you're working with others, with ministers, cabinet meetings, cabinet committee meetings, or whatever. You know, you've less control over your diary when you're a chief of staff or a chief of defence staff than you had when you were a CNC.
Yes.
When you were a squadron leader or a wing commander. And I found, you know, that I was having to be in my office as CDS by 9 o'clock without the leisurely stroll over Green Park. And that meant that, you know, because in the day when I was MA, I got in shortly after nine, you know, with a 30-minute lead time on Dick Hull, also in Elworthy, which gave me time to get through the mail and sort out the papers and be all there in their in-tray, ready for them to get started on. So it realised that, you know, one's own outer office was working much longer hours than everyone had in my day. And, of course, the modern communications and emails and so on now meant that the pressure, I think, was much greater. Which, you know, I suppose I was fairly pressurised, but I don't think I was as pressurised as today's youngsters must be.
Yes, and it's an interesting thing that as a consequence of that technology, well, revolution in communications, even though our armed forces are much smaller and our responsibilities in one sense are much greatly reduced, the burden, probably the burden actually on the people at the top is greater, would you say, or not? This instant desire, you know, there's a catastrophe, a minor catastrophe in Iraq, something happens. And instantly, officers at the rank of lieutenant colonel are suddenly being interviewed by TV crews.
Oh, yes. Yes, I just wonder
whether that sort of thing ratchets up the chain. It doesn't.
Oh, yes. All of that does. Because, I mean, just to take that as an aside, for example, during the first Gulf War when I was CDS, you know, the microphone live was being proffered to your spokesman in Riyadh, to somebody here in London, and to somebody in Washington. And if there was a smidgen of difference between the reactions, we hear that a tornado has been shot down. The Iraqis claim, you know. First, you're not sure whether the Iraqi claim is right or not. Or CNN has said the Iraqis are claimed, so you don't know whether CNN have got it right, let alone whether the Iraqis got it right. And, you know, do you appear totally dumb? You don't know what's going on. And you can't sort of say, well, CNN get it wrong 9 times out of 10, because this is the one time they didn't get it wrong. So there is a great difficulty in media management. And, of course, the way the individual comes across, if he's sort of shifty or... finding the right personality to do that with the confidence. And I think Brian Burridge, for example, in the last Gulf War, was the commander out there, I thought was extremely good, because he didn't let the media bounce him, because there's the inevitable leading question.
Yes.
I mean, we've seen it with the poor Scots Guards, which... You know, some of these 19-year-olds say, "Are you a bit frightened?" You know, the leading question. I mean, you can't say no, and you don't want to say yes. So what do you do? Shake your nodding head. The media management wasn't the sort of problem that it is today.
Yes.
Is this live global treatment, which we never ever had to cope with. I mean, there was certainly the spinning and all that. I think there's nothing new to that. Maybe it lived under different names. But the pressures of those are thing, and that some people take to being good with the media better than others.
Yeah.
I don't count myself as good with the media, so I try and avoid it. And I constantly get rung up from time to time when I appear on Panorama or something. And Fred, I invariably say no. Anyway, pretty dated now to be asked, but I mean, I think it's not my... I mean, I did a bit when I was CDS. Press conferences and occasionally on the media, but even then, you know, you were actually running a war and you weren't too keen to... You know, I felt it was for ministers to make the running of it, rather than for us who were there to do their bidding.
Yeah, to execute.
It's interesting now, there's much more freedom for, I don't know if freedom's the right word, but chiefs of staff are much more to be seen on the media. They appear here. I never ever came over here to talk to the Commons or the Lords Defence Groups. My successors, all three services and CDS all come at least once a year and twice a year, which is, you know, a different way of running it. You can say, well, good luck to them, and certainly from the audience point of view, it's very good because you actually get to see them, and learn their body language, and
yes,
and know about them.
Yes,
but you know, at the end of the day, they can't be other than their master's mouthpieces. I mean, they can't go off in order and say, I think, you know, Tom King or Jeff Hoon's an absolute clown. Save that for later, if at all. So, anyway,
well,
enough's enough.
We'll end on that note. Thank you very much. And one or two of your, certainly one of your predecessors as CDS, said a great deal more about politicians than that, both and on and off the tape. But we'll leave that to
Peter Hill Norton being there. I think it was he who said, for his memorial service, no ministers in his will.
I don't doubt it. Yeah. Well, look, thank you very, very much. We'll finish here and we'll resume on a new date, spring 68, as a group captain.
Yes. Right. Okay.
Thank you very much. Lord Craig, thank you very much for continuing with your contribution to the Sound Archive. Before we get into the meat of our second interview this afternoon, our second conversation this afternoon, I think there's a small correction left over from the previous one. I did refer to as Commandant of Gamut, which is wrong, I think.
Yes, you'll recall that there was an Air Vice Marshal in my day, Commandant at the RAF College. Of Granville, and there were a couple of our commodores, and then there was a station commander or unit commander, a group captain, and that was me, and I went there in March 1968 and was there for nearly 2.5 years till August 1970, the end of August 1970. It was a big change from my previous job. I was where I'd been working with the Chief of Defence Staff in the Ministry of Defence, and it took me a little bit of time, I think, to establish the right relationship with my elders and betters there, and they with me, because I'd been used, I suppose, to dealing with a large number of very, very senior officers. And these weren't quite so senior, but they thought they were very senior. There was no question that I should abuse in any way the relationship. So, but we got on very well together. It was Jimmy Stack was the comet of there. We became very good friends in later life. So it wasn't a serious matter, but it struck me at the time that I was being advised once to recognize the seniority of the people I was dealing with. It always struck me as slightly ironic. Anyway, that's really beside the point. What is to say about Cranwell? I mean, Cranwell was at that stage going through an interesting period in its life. I suppose there always will be interesting periods. I won't recount why the Royal Air Force got Cranwell, because that'll be well known to whoever happens to be listening to this. But it was at this time that the concept of trying to get degree courses for junior officers coming indeed into all three services was around. And there was, particularly for the engineers, there was an anxiety to try and get them some form of degree recognition. And in those days, the university something committee, UCC anyway, whatever it was very against. I mean, nowadays with degrees being issued more or less to a penny and purely on postal and external study, it was very surprising, because the quality of the education, which was the given, was well up to degree standard, but the degree of awarding authorities just would not recognize it. And at that time there was this strong feeling that if you were going to attract the right quality of youngster into the services, you had to fish in a pool of individuals who were being told by the school headmasters and their careers masters that they should go on to university before they went into employment in some way. And certainly from the Royal Air Force's point of view, we wanted to get them still pretty young. Nowadays, I'm afraid we do have to accept that they're well into their 20s before they're in the front line. But certainly way back, and when we're talking about in the mid-60s, the concept of quite old first tourists wasn't terribly
What's the disadvantage to the RAF?
Well, it's very straightforward. If you spend several million pounds training a fighter pilot, as you must, I mean, probably nowadays, probably 10 or 15, in those days it was, you know, equivalent money, very big money. And that training then has got to be amortized over the productive life of the individual who's been trained. So if you start him off at 18, get him into the front line 2021, he'll be flying for you for 15 years or more. And so the cost is amortized over that longer period. Whereas if he doesn't get into the front line service till his mid-20s, you've at least lost a third, maybe more, of the investment. And of course there's a bigger turnover, so you've got a bigger training machine, and it is not ideal purely from a service cost benefit. But there are all these other pressures, and eventually the RAF and along with the other two services has had to accept that they're not going to attract many. They'll always attract a few straight from school into the services, because if they're bright and they've got the A-level grades and so on, which one's looking for, or whatever it was in those days, school certificates, they'll almost certainly be heading for some form of university degree. So it was a very interesting area. We got all these cadets there, and we've got junior engineers, cadets, doing that training, doing quite a lot, certainly as far as the engineers are concerned, which was well up to degree standard, but degrees could not be awarded. I mean, I think the others will know far more about it. I just sort of pop it in as it was a very much a live subject. And there were also the concepts of bringing Henlow, which was the engineering training unit, up to Cranwell.
And Cramwell in those days certainly didn't want to lose all the OSSA training qualities, the indoctrination of service ethos and so on, which a cadet college, by its very nature, is geared to do. Nowadays, of course, I mean, we've had to sacrifice that. It's nothing like as long. It's not a three-year stint at Cramwell. It's a matter of months. And the further training quite often will be done with civilian instructors. So there's been a very, very big change. But at the time I'm talking about, it was perceived to be absolutely essential that all entries to the Air Force, and I'm sure the other two services, had to be trained and brought up and indoctrinated in every conceivable way by their own service. And it was on the basis of that you brought on a new generation. It was way back in trenches thinking of setting up Cramwell as a college, cadet college in the first place, because you were able then to train people and inspire them with all the right sort of attitudes and attributes of loyalty and service and so on. So it was, although it wasn't any direct part of my responsibility, because this was sort of for the air commodores and the commandant, I did get inevitably involved with it, and of course found it very interesting because of my own particular entry into the service, which had not been through Cranwell. But otherwise, I don't think it's very much I'd want to say about Cranwell. I mean, I had 2.5 years there. I had a happy time there. I think one of the it was a good period in one's life to get to know for the first time civilians in the local community. Like most major bases, there were a number of honorary members of the officers' mess who were good supporters of the Royal Air Force and regular attenders at guest nights or annual dances or whatever, receptions. And my wife and I made friends with a number of those, and they've lasted through the, you know, whenever it was, 40 years, which is, I think, something which all services need to do, which is to have a good relationship with the local community. And certainly Cramwell, because of its stature and standing in not only the Royal Air Force, but because it was a major base in that part of Lincolnshire. And generally speaking, the Lincolnshire folk were very positively friendly and positive about the service. So it was something which I always remembered in later life, that it was very important to keep this service-civilian relationship warm, and then, of course, if there are any problems, somebody crashes on their land, or somebody misbehaves, or whatever. You've got at least a good chance of putting things right before they get out of hand and everybody goes to court or something. So I think that's really, I think, all I need to say about Cramwell, unless you can think of something which I should be saying, which I haven't said.
And no, I can't. What I would ask is this. And it's going back to the degree question and training and losing the people too quickly. Would it be correct then would the correct deduction be from what you've said that you have frontline pilots and frontline aircrew only for about 15 years? And therefore, if you lose from age 20 to 25, which is what I'm gathering you said, there's your third gone. You've only got them from 25 to 35-ish.
Yeah, well, it's not quite as simple as that because, in relation to that, one's really talking about the fast jet force, the fighter force, where, you know, as you get older, the pressures can become just a bit too great. There are other aircraft types to fly. But you also, because of the structure of the Air Force, with all officer air crew, your pyramid is not straight up from the bottom up to the top,
below the age of about 40. It is quite broad, or it used to be anyway. It's not so broad now because everything is shrinking, but it's relatively broad compared with the number of appointments at the various more senior levels. So there has to be a wasting anyway, or a short service commission or early retirement, or whatever you like to call it. And many people, of course, want that. They come in for the flying, but they don't see the going on to 55. So it's not a difficult thing to manage, but it's got to be managed. And it's in that wider bottom part that your big investment, of course, is being made. For those who stay on and go on to the more senior ranks, well, there isn't anything like the earlier investment. You may put them through a staff college or a IDC, RCDS, or something like that. But your relative investment in them, you'll get much more out of them productively. And by that time, they've pretty well amortized their flying costs anyway.